A few months ago, Martha Stewart invited rap star Snoop Dogg into her kitchen to bake brownies.
Look, can't you rap while we're doing this? Tell me what you're doing and rap.
Trying to bake some brownies, but we're missing the most important part of the brownies.
Which is?
No sticks, no seeds,
which is?
Well, they stuck with a traditional recipe, about 7 ingredients and instructions that can fit on an index card. Basic brownies are about the easiest thing to bake. That is, unless you're baking them for our men and women in uniform. We came across a blog post at Reason Magazine this past week that linked to the Pentagon's official brownie recipe. It is 26 pages long, with detailed specs for the finished product.
Section 3.3.5. The brownie shall be completely enrobed with a continuous uniform...
Section 3.2.5.3. Shelled walnut pieces shall be of the small pea size classification.
Section 3.2.6. Whole eggs may be liquid or frozen and shall have been processed...
We called up Jeremy Witsit, who works for the Defense Department's Combat Feeding Directorate, to find out why parts of his recipe seem to require a dictionary and a lawyer.
One thing we like to say is, what would happen if you cooked a meal, stored it in a stifling hot warehouse, dropped it out of an airplane, dragged it through the mud, left it out with bugs and vermin, and ate it 3 years later? Nothing if it were an MRE.
And it's true, these brownies will last for about 3 years inside a sealed military field-grade food packet known as an MRE. But how do they taste? We called up Penny Karras. She's a baker who owns Hello Cupcake here in Washington, D.C., and she agreed to bake them for us. Okay, Penny, we are in your kitchen. First of all, thank you for doing this.
Sure.
Okay, and have you read the recipe, all 26 pages?
I read the relevant parts of the recipe and skimmed the non-relevant parts.
Okay, now I have it. We have it in front of us here, and
yes.
I'm going to ask you to make sure that we have all of the right ingredients. So let's just go over the list here.
Okay.
Do you have flour?
We do.
Okay. You got shortening, some kind of shortening?
We don't use it, but we got it.
You got it, okay. So you got some nuts, right? We're using...
Walnuts today.
Walnuts, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Are the nuts small pea size classification, U.S. number one pieces of the U.S. standards for grades of shelled nuts?
They are small pea size classification.
Do the nuts pass through a 4/16 inch diameter round hole screen?
We measure them with a tape measure. We don't have that type of screen to measure them, so we did it another way. But
okay.
Yes.
Let's get to it.
Okay. The first thing I'm going to do is whip the eggs. So I'll get the eggs out. The recipe also calls for dextrose, which is another type of sugar. And we don't have it in our kitchen. We're a small scratch bakery.
Penny whips up the eggs, shortening, flour, nuts, sugar, cocoa, and vanilla into a thick paste. And then she scrapes it into a pan and pops it in the oven for about 20 minutes. And then they're ready to eat.
You started to cut a few here, right?
Yes.
And you have to cut it to the appropriate size when cool. The dimensions of the coated brownie shall not exceed 3.5 inches by 2.5 inches by 5/8 inch.
Mm-hmm. Looks like we have exceeded the height of the specification by about 3/8 of an inch.
You know what? There have been lots of people who have cheated the Pentagon out of contracts.
Right.
I think they'll let you get away with this one. All right. So we got it. Now the question is the texture of these brownies firm but not hard? So can we try?
Sure.
Okay. Oof.
It's not so great.
Yeah. They're awful. They're
mm-hmm.
not very good. And they're really crumbly, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they're designed for MREs. They're designed to be preserved for a long time.
Packaged.
And these would last
a good long time.
And a final note to this story. The Defense Department has recently streamlined the recipe. It now includes instructions for cake and muffin tops as well. And as for the length, it's now 31 pages. Thanks to Penny Karras at Hello Cupcake in Washington, D.C. for baking the brownies, and to Art Silverman and Jim Howard for reading the recipe, which you can find at our website, npr.org. We're back with All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz.
America has not succeeded by stepping out of the currents of cooperation. We have succeeded by steering those currents in the direction of liberty. Justice. So nations thrive by meeting their responsibilities and face consequences when they don't.
That's President Obama at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point earlier today. He was outlining a new national security strategy that emphasizes diplomacy and alliances. Our friend James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic, is here to give us some context. Jim, hi.
Nice to talk to you again, Guy.
Now, Jim, I'm already reading analysis of this speech and claims that President Obama pointedly repudiated the strategy of his predecessor, George W. Bush. But I wonder whether historians will actually, you know, look at this speech and say that was the turning point for American security strategy.
I think yes, but in this sense. Certainly rhetorically and conceptually, this couldn't be more different from the speech that President George W. Bush gave in the same venue 8 years ago when he was propounding his doctrine of preemptive war, which led to the invasion of Iraq. But actually what struck me about this speech was its continuity with some other parts of American diplomatic policy. And I mean in the sort of immediate sense that Secretary of Defense Robert Gates has been building up to this kind of approach in an extraordinary series of speeches over the past year. But when I read the Obama speech today, the first speech I thought of and the one I went back to read was President Eisenhower's farewell address to the nation in January 1961, almost 50 years ago. That's a speech that's famous for his warnings about the effect of the military-industrial complex.
Right.
But really what he's saying is the same message that President Obama was saying today, that a combination of economic strength, moral leadership, diplomatic networks, and, of course, military power is the way America can advance its interests in the world.
Jim, moving on to another area related to diplomacy and security, North Korea. U.S. intelligence agencies are now saying that North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-il, personally authorized that deadly attack on a South Korean warship about 2 months ago. They are also saying that they believe he did it to help secure the succession of his youngest son. Can you explain how those things are related?
I don't think anybody can fully or completely explain what's going on in North Korea. And I remember very clearly an interview that Bill Clinton gave, and he was talking about one of the North Korean crises. And he said what makes this regime and this state unique is it's the only state in the world whose power over the world is wholly negative. Really, the only way it can get attention is to make trouble elsewhere. And the way in which this might fit into the logic of North Korean succession is that Kim Jong-il and his father, Kim Il-sung, the way they have presented themselves as the saviors of the nation is standing up against the U.S. in particular and its alleged lackeys in South Korea. And so if he's now preparing for the succession to his son, Kim Jong-un, then this is a way of reminding the populace of the greatness of the Kim family.
Finally, Jim, you wrote a long article for The Atlantic on Google recently, and I'm wondering what you make of all this controversy, you know, regarding not just Google but Facebook and other websites in terms of privacy issues, you know, how much information they are passing along to advertisers about us.
Over the last decade, when we've had political arguments about the effect of the internet, they've mainly been about state control and censorship and firewalls and all the rest. And I think the next generation of political and cultural and moral arguments will concern privacy. From a technological point of view, you know, devices are more and more aware of where we are at all times. Our cell phones always know where we are. And from a commercial point of view, the business model of Google and Facebook and many of their competitors is to collect as much information about the public as they can so as to more precisely target the advertisements they want to deliver. The way in which this will stay within what Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, has called the limits of creepiness will be an ongoing matter of commercial ethics and, I'm sure, legislation around the world.
And, Jim, we're going to be hearing more about Facebook and privacy on this program, All Things Considered, tomorrow, so tune in.
I will certainly do so.
That's James Fallows. He's national correspondent for The Atlantic. He joins us on this program most Saturdays. Jim, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Guy. Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Sometime around the end of last summer, economists said the recession was over. But long-term unemployment is higher than it's been since the Great Depression, and growth is slowing. Add to that the dramatic declines on Wall Street these past few weeks, and you may be forgiven for asking, is it really over? We'll hear one economist's answer to that question in a moment, but first to financial regulation. With the passage of the Senate Finance Bill this week, Congress looks set to adopt the biggest regulatory changes to the financial industry since the 1930s. Those rules are designed, in theory, to prevent another collapse like the kind we saw in 2008. But what does it mean for the rest of us? We begin with NPR's Audie Cornish.
First of all, we're going to get a new regulator in the form of this Consumer Financial Protection Bureau or agency. So far, we've only had banking regulators, so they didn't know what to do with mortgage lenders who weren't banks, or an AIG, which sold insurance but also did some betting in other kinds of risky trades on the side.
They were focused on the big guys, not
on
the consumers.
Exactly. So you're going to have a consumer-oriented bureau, which is going to watch over all the lending that's, you know, in your file cabinet at home, your checkbook and your student loan and your mortgage. All that paperwork is going to be watched by someone. And then the regulators themselves as a whole will now be tasked with watching over the entire system to monitor for big sort of seismic shifts or changes. Is everyone starting to trade in one kind of thing, and what's that thing made up of? And the idea is that once they get a sense of what's going on, they can drill down and maybe address the problem.
Well, what does this mean for the average consumer? Will it mean that mortgage paperwork will be easier? Will it mean that our credit card fees will go down? What does it mean for people, you know, like us?
Well, the Republicans who oppose the bill would probably say regulation never makes anything easier. So if you could think about it that way, you're going to have an agency now who is going to be looking at that mortgage. And if it's an adjustable rate mortgage or a subprime mortgage for someone who doesn't have great credit, things are going to be a lot more stringent. You won't be able to get a loan without really showing evidence you can pay for that loan. Mm. We've just come out of a few years where you didn't have to do that.
How would something like the regulation of financial derivatives affect consumers? That's also in a provision in there.
It's a huge part of the bill, and it's actually the most contentious part of the bill because it's a big unregulated market. Basically, bankers or investors or even farmers or airlines, they can call up banks and say, I think the price of oil is going to go down or up. Hmm. I'm going to put some money down against that to protect me from when that price change happens. The problem is during the loan crisis, people were doing that with loans, bundled packages of loans, which are called mortgage-backed securities. So they were betting
default,
on whether whether these things would go up or down. They were betting on whether or not you were going to pay off your mortgage. And when a bunch of people didn't, that's when we saw the crisis. And we saw a company like AIG, the insurance firm, who had been dabbling in this kind of trading, fall apart.
So in theory, this is going to prevent that from happening.
It's going to set up a way to see further down the horizon if something like that is coming up. A little bit like a tornado, though. I mean, I think ostensibly it's supposed to be able to look out on the plains and say, that doesn't look right, what's coming down. I mean, the thing to understand about this bill is repeatedly we heard the author, Chris Dodd, the head of the banking committee, say, this is not going to prevent the next crisis. That's not the promise here. The promise is we will be able to handle the next crisis. Before, it was ad hoc. You had Ben Bernanke and Hank Paulson kind of in rooms, making phone calls. This is going to make a system so that you don't have regulators going to lawmakers in the middle of the night and asking for $700 billion.
That's NPR's Audie Cornish. Audie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
In the 12 years that Sex and the City has existed, the city has always been New York. Bergdorf Goodman, Cosmos Manolos, at least for that trio. But when the new movie opens on Thursday, that city will also be Abu Dhabi, in the United Arab Emirates. NPR's Elizabeth Blair asks, why?
Sex and the City has always been laced with fantasy. Writer-producer Michael Patrick King says in a recession, that was more important than ever. He says he took his cues from filmmakers who worked during the Depression.
And all of a sudden they started doing Top Hat and extravagant getaway things and road pictures and far, far away adventures. And I thought, that's my job.
For Carrie, Miranda, Charlotte, and Samantha, the Arab world is exotic.
Desert moons, Scheherazade, magic carpets.
Camels.
Oh, can you hear me now? Harry! Miranda, I'm home!
Camels, Abu Dhabi. No?
I've been to Abu Dhabi several times, and believe me, I've been everywhere in Abu Dhabi, and I couldn't find a camel.
Dr. Jack Shaheen has written extensively on how Muslims and Arabs have been portrayed in American movies.
No matter where the film is shot, inevitably we're going to have camels, and we're going to have the desert and some tents. I mean, that's how Hollywood traditionally defines the Middle East.
Now, Sex and the City 2 isn't pretending this is real. Even the press materials acknowledge they had to go to West Africa to get the camels. The film was shot in Morocco, not Abu Dhabi. And throughout, the photography, the clothes, the music are stunning, if not authentic. Michael Patrick King.
We didn't kid around. We really went there and made a big, old-fashioned Hollywood movie. But hopefully with a current sensibility involved.
What's the sense in a boring business dinner when you have sand dunes and sunset?
Michael Patrick King references lots of old movies, including the screwball comedies from the 1930s and 40s.
I hear this country's where they do the dance of the seven bells.
Like Road to Morocco with Bing Crosby and Bob Hope. Interesting choice, says Jack Shaheen.
Road to Morocco is probably one of the most stereotypical films ever to come out of Hollywood.
At one point, Bob Hope is in full Sultan-esque attire. In Sex and the City, Carrie Bradshaw wears a turban designed by Philip Tracy of London. Depending on your point of view, she either looks silly or fashion-forward. Michael Patrick King.
Pat Field and I, the costume designer, had major conversations about how to be creative and cover the shoulders to be respectful for the customs. And what they came up with was this intricate and almost undefinable collection of scarves and shirts that turned into shruggings and jackets. And it's so funny because when Carrie finally does drop her jacket and show her shoulders, it's almost as if she's naked.
But there are no harem girls or snake charmers in this Sex and the City. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. At the opening of his new book, Con Eagledon says, "There's a moment in some lives when the world grows still and a decision must be made. At such moments, there is no one to save you." Con Eagledon joins us from London. He and one of his brothers wrote the best-selling Dangerous Book for Boys, which offered instructions on how to build a treehouse, tan a hide, or build a soapbox racer, which we did with him. This new book with another brother offers boys, and not just boys, stories to inspire them about men and women who, when history and circumstance called, replied with grace and pluck to save themselves and others. Con Eagledon co-wrote The Dangerous Book of Heroes. He joins us from the BBC in London. Con, thanks very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
What's a hero?
A hero, I suppose. At least we've gone on a fairly simple definition, is one who inspires us, one who has courage and possibly just a bit of style. We decided fairly early on they don't always have to be likable. Mm-hmm. They don't always have to be a good father, a good brother, a good son, or a good mother, of course. But at the same time, they had to have an unusual life, to have been part of great changing times, and to some extent to show what you can do with a single life.
You have some names which probably wouldn't surprise anybody. George Washington.
Yes.
Although coming from you, that is a little surprising. Coming from any Briton, it's a little surprising. Daniel Boone, the brave RAF fighters who won the Battle of Britain.
Yes.
But you also put in Harry Houdini.
I know this is a tricky one, but you can't argue with his bravery for a start, and you can't argue with his style. He had a certain amount of dash. I mean, you know, not since P.T. Barnum has someone sort of had that attitude to making the legend greater than the man. But he was also a personal hero of mine when I was a boy. Mm-hmm. I absolutely loved the idea of escapology, and I had a good go at it and, you know, ended up like a lot of children, tied up in ropes and having to call for help. So, you know, there are, I mean, this will always be... This will always be a series of personal choices in many ways. I mean, you can never have everybody who deserves to be in a book like this.
Yeah.
So you do the best you can. But I think we have some pretty good stories in here, and that's what we were hoping to do, get inspiring stories that might, some of which might otherwise be forgotten.
Florence Nightingale.
Yes. I mean, hers is an interesting story. I mean, apart from anything else, when she was building that hospital in Scutari, I mean, discovering that there was a dead horse stuck in the underground water system. So, I mean, to explain one of the reasons why there was so much typhoid and dysentery and everything else, she actually introduced a sort of modern standard of nursing. And when she arrived in this Turkey hospital, she, you know, she found it as a sort of warehouse with thousands of people just laid out on the ground to die. It was a nasty business. And what I wanted with that chapter was to put in perspective the bravery of other people of that time, because this was what awaited you if you went into a battle. If you were lucky enough not to be killed but only to be wounded, you were entering a horrific world. which, you know, she did her very best to improve, and I thought that was worth putting in.
If I had to nominate a favorite chapter, it would be the story of the women of SOE.
Yes.
Special operations.
I mean, they were the special operations executive. They were often parachuted into France during World War II to act as radio operators and to liaise with resistance people on the ground. Mm-hmm. So they had an awful lot of information. They all carried code books, and if they were caught, they were guaranteed to be tortured for that information. And they knew this. They were all young women. They all had a great loyalty to Britain, or at least an antipathy to the Nazis, and because they were French and British and American and a few other places. And in many ways, this story is constantly tragic, because after years of work, they were captured, they were tortured, and this was a very sad one to write, because there's no happy ending for this. These are young women. These aren't sort of young soldiers. Yeah. Young male soldiers carried away on dreams of glory. It was often difficult, unpleasant work, in terrible fear of the knock on the door at any point, and then finishing in a very grim way for many of them. But they did it, and I wanted to keep that aspect of courage in the book.
I feel the need in 2010 to talk about the passengers on United Flight 93.
One of the reasons I wanted to do the passengers in Flight 93 was partly because I was, like a lot of people, I remember exactly where I was when the Twin Towers were hit on that particular day. I was teaching in a comprehensive school in London. I remember seeing it on the news, and the whole world stopped. It was an act of courage, extraordinary courage, by a group of people who were completely ordinary. They were just passengers on a plane, and almost all of us have been passengers on a plane at some point. And the thought of having 35 minutes to realize that you're in serious trouble, realize it's a hostage situation, but you're not going to be taken down and negotiated for. And in fact, if you don't act, everyone is going to die, and possibly the plane will be used as a weapon. They were the only flight in the air that day that had that information in time to act on it. That is an extraordinary thing. And it's inspiring, because they were just, flying on that particular day without realizing it was the last day of their lives. And, you see, I never know quite how to say this, and I'll try and say it.
Yeah.
Because it just sounds obsequious or sucking up. But I realised on that particular day that I share a great culture with America, that I realised that it's like the King of Nepal once said to Britain, that when you win, we win. When you fail, when you fall, we fall with you. And I felt a fantastic bond at that particular time, that we were under attack, not just America.
Let me ask you about our modern definition of heroism. Because it does seem to me there's a phrase that's entered the language in recent years, exit strategy. And of course, fruitless, vain, charge of the light brigade kind of courage is something that is understandably diminished these days. But the term exit strategy sometimes nettles me.
Well, yes, it does a little bit, actually. It's a different world now in many ways. I mean, the value of a human life has frankly gone up in the West, and that has to be a good thing. That has to be, something we can be proud of, so that when we lose a single soldier, his name is on the news across the land, across the world. That said, I think, thankfully, we still do value bravery as an essential characteristic. I mean, it's almost the oldest human activity to sit around a campfire and say, this is a story of a brave man, we value this. If you grow up to be cowards, you will be less than, an impressive human being. And I think, that if we are cowards, then it does rather shame the memories of those people who weren't, if they were able to hear us.
Con Eagledon, together with his brother David, has co-written the book, The Dangerous Book of Heroes, just out now. Con, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can read about the Gurkhas, these staunch Nepalese soldiers who serve Great Britain around the world, in an excerpt from Con Eagledon's book on our website, npr.org.
Now, believe it or not, even Pentagon brownies can be made to look delicious for the cameras. That's what Dolores Custer does for a living. She's a professional food stylist, and she's written a book about how it's done. It's called Food Styling, and Dolores Custer joins me from Portland. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, we have all seen that the perfect bowl of cereal, right? With the perfect blueberry or the perfect strawberry, just hitting the milk, you've got that perfect splash, and then these perfectly situated cornflakes, and they each have a few perfect drops of milk on them. Is that milk?
Some of the times it is, most of the time it's not. In the early days, that splash was acrylic. and we would have a model maker make the splash. Today, with digital, it can be a real splash, or oftentimes it's illustrated.
Computer-generated?
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
CGI exactly. for, like, your cornflakes bowl?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, if we're selling milk, we have to use milk. If we're selling the cereal, then we sort through and we find what I call flakes with character. We don't want perfect flat flakes because they're boring. So we like to try to find flakes that have some twists and turns to them and that sort of thing. And we arrange those in a bowl. And then we do use something other than milk if it's going to take the photographer a long time to shoot.
Which is sort of a combination of what? What is that substance?
Oh, it's really simple. It's either Elmer's glue, but my favorite and the one that I use all the time is Wild Root Hair Tonic.
You know, it's funny you say that because I used both of those in my cereal this morning.
I'm sure
they were. Elmer's glue is delicious.
I can taste it now.
Yeah, it's much, much better than skim milk. Now, I was looking at your list of things that you sort of pull out of your toolbox, and some of these things, you know, are fairly innocuous, and some of them, some of the things are just toxic. Mortician's wax, something called poop freeze. What is poop freeze, and what do you use it for?
This was a new one, and I haven't used poop freeze. This was a tip that another food stylist gave me who walks her dog.
Oh, this is a chemical that freezes dog poo. I know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, so that you can pick it up.
And how do you use this in food styling?
Well, if your ice cream is melting, you can spray the ice cream and it cools it down and keeps it from melting for a little while. I mean, the reason that our world is this kind of crazy world where we're spraying ice cream and so forth is because photographers need time to get the lighting just right and the exposure. And there are foods that don't do well with sitting there over time. My mentor said, food is like children. It doesn't like to behave in front of company. And these items are things that are there to make food behave.
The cover of your book, I should describe the cover of your book, Food Styling, because it is a, it's like a Dagwood sandwich. It's a Kaiser roll, and in the middle of this Kaiser roll are, I don't know how many dozens of pieces of cheese and different kinds of deli meats and perfectly green lettuce. How did you make that?
Every time we receive an assignment, one of the things that food stylists do will say, now, where is the problem? And with this, if you make a tall sandwich, the weight of the food on top of each other presses everything down and it just looks flat and not interesting. What I do is I have the photographer put a bolt up through the plate and then I put the bun down through the bolt and I start arranging the lettuce and cheese and so forth.
So if I came to your house tonight for dinner, should I expect to have a beautifully presented, waxed, sprayed down, glue stick, delicious hair gel meal? Or is it just going to be kind of a big mess?
It's not going to be a mess. It won't be a mess.
It'll be non-toxic though, right?
It'll be totally non-toxic. Just because it's pretty doesn't mean that it's good. We as food stylists, we're always looking for the pretty ones. You know, we want the lemons that are just the right size, that have the right color yellow, the right texture on their skin, and all of that stuff. But I know that the juiciest lemons have a certain look to them, and those would be lemons that I wouldn't pick, you know, for my food styling assignment.
Well, that's pretty good advice. Dolores Custer is the person who makes you believe that the food you're about to buy really looks as delicious as it does in magazines. Her new book is called Food Styling. Dolores, thank you so much.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure. I enjoyed this.